This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District. With new commercial construction, more than 350 acres of green space, parks, and sports complex. More information at nnmd.org. Grow near.
Welcome to this week's Party Politics. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Well, we hope you had a great holiday. We hope you have a wonderful new year so far. I assume that 2018 will be a kind of quiet year on the national scene, Jay, right?
Oh, always, always.
Well, I thought the Texans were going to be in the Super Bowl, so what do I know? But there you go. But we do have a very interesting week, and so we've kicked off 2018 with a bang. What are some things that hit our radar screen this week, Jay?
Well, Brandon, you know, you probably should know that it's not the size of the button that matters. It's how you use your button.
Right.
Or better said, my button's bigger than your button.
Right.
Well, apparently the president of the United States is in a Twitter war, shockingly, with the president of North Korea on having the nuclear button on his desk, created quite a row back and forth. Leaving aside from the fact that the president doesn't actually have a button on his desk, there's something called the nuclear football, which is a whole other set of issues, but it created quite a to-do about the president, and critics often were saying that the president was sort of minimizing the potential risk of war and then the seriousness of it by using these kinds of analogies.
Well, as long as we're talking about a Twitter war and not an actual war, I think we're safe, but you make a really good point. This is an alarming and dangerous escalation of this conflict in a way that didn't need to be done. And we've talked about this several times before on the podcast. And the president's sort of geopolitical strategy seems to be driven by what he sees on the news. And that's not a way to be able to keep us out of these conflicts and or to solve other greater conflicts. So, you know, people's hangovers aren't even like gone yet. And the president has already fumbled the ball when it comes to foreign policy. So it's worth noting that this is something that over the years, presidents have handled very gingerly. The president has not handled this very gingerly. The U.S. lived for basically two generations under a direct threat of nuclear war. And the fact that the president is playing around with this in this way is, I think, both dangerous as well as alarming.
Well, we know at the close of 2017, the sort of the signature item for the president was tax reform. They'd worked sort of at a feverish pace towards the end to get it done. Well, in that bill were a series of provisions that made it difficult for several states, large tax states, especially with the deductibility of state and local taxes. Well, the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, has decided to sue the federal government specifically on this point. And so it'll be interesting to see. So for years, we saw Texas and other conservative states, red states, suing President Obama on seemingly a weekly basis. Well, now, after climate change and now this, we're seeing kind of the reverse happen, where you have blue state governors suing the federal government.
Yeah, both New York and California have suggested that they might pursue this legal strategy in addition to restructuring their state tax code to essentially develop a process whereby they move from an income tax, which they have, to a payroll tax system, or create like charitable organizations which people can donate to, which the contributions would then be deductible. So this is a complicated process to undo this. And I think much of this is political. I mean, obviously these states want to be able to save, you know, their constituents the requirement to pay this money, but this is a serious enterprise, right, which could create some massive economic problems for the country. But I'm not so sure it's not smart for Trump and the Republicans to play this way. It essentially effectively raises taxes on citizens in blue states, putting pressure on those elected officials to have to respond. So what's your kind of read on this? Is this a chess move, or is this like a legitimate way that the government has to be able to save revenue to be able to pay for the rest of the tax cuts?
No, there's no doubt. I mean, I think for large, high-tax blue states, it's a big deal. New York State, it could potentially lose, you know, tens of thousands of more high net worth individuals who just simply want to leave
for
no other reason than the taxing element of it. Yeah. The same is probably
move
true
to
of
Connecticut, right?
Exactly. Or the same is true of folks in California as well. So part of the issue ends up being is that it's sort of a preservation of your tax base, because for years, personal income taxes at the state level have been deductible. Now, the property taxes have not always been deductible, and that's a relatively recent phenomena. So, this is a big issue for these states, and so it's only natural that they're going to sue. Ultimately, the legality of the suit, I think, is probably going to be questionable.
Yeah.
This is a political battle, not a legal one, and ultimately it's going to get fought at the ballot box.
Yeah, Governor Cuomo called this the first federal double taxation in history. It's not clear there's a legal basis for this, but so I agree with you with that. Speaking of legal issues, the president has dissolved his famed electoral commission. Jay, tell us about it.
Yeah, apparently, the president had previously said that there were millions of illegal people voting, and that's why
without evidence,
which is why he didn't really win the popular vote. But in fact, he claims he did win it because of that. Well, it turns out that he's decided to drop this election commission, and that was the result of the fact that he claimed that he wasn't getting cooperation from many states. The net result of it is that a large issue about voter fraud and voter integrity was sort of diverted by this commission, essentially. And so instead of looking at the underlying question of sort of the integrity of the electoral process, this sort of sideshow occurred. And now I think the president has recognized, whatever mileage they were going to get from it is now passed.
Yeah, I'd seen this described as part of the blundered Bannon rollout. So we'll talk more about Bannon in a minute. But this is clearly, I think, an early mistake. And the president was smart here. They were fishing for some kind of major finding on voter fraud, and they hadn't found it. So it's better, frankly, to cut the line and move on.
Well, speaking of Bannon, we have seen probably something that we haven't seen since the days of Hulk Hogan, switching sides in the WWE, and that is Steve Bannon turning on Donald Trump and Donald Trump declaring all-out war on Bannon.
Wow. This started, because Steve Bannon implied that the meetings between Trump associates and Russians during the 2016 elections were treasonous. The president shot back in Hulk Hogan style by saying that essentially that Bannon had not only lost his job, but also had lost his mind, that the president had beat 17 other candidates and that he didn't need Bannon to do that, and that Bannon was learning that winning wasn't easy without Donald Trump. So I think this probably qualifies as the worst political breakup in history. But my question to you is, does this muddy the water in terms of who is the leader of these Trump votes? Is there a kind of soothsayer for what the Trump voter thinks and feels and what they're going to do? We thought it was Steve Bannon. Maybe it's Trump. It's shown politically. Maybe that hasn't panned out. What do you take from this?
Yeah, look, I think it was inevitable that when you have egos the size of Steve Bannon and Donald Trump, that they weren't going to be able to coexist. And we've seen this, to a lesser extent with other sort of political relationships. Famously, George W. Bush and Karl Rove, Rove was often called Bush's brain.
Yeah. Bush called him Turd Blossom.
Yes, exactly.
to keep him down a lot. Gotcha.
Right. But part of the issue here is there's always a sense of, I want to be my own man. If you're the leader in the case of Donald Trump, I don't want to be a secondary figure to Steve Bannon. And Bannon, I think, he believes this movement. He's been at this for a long time through Breitbart. He is a sort of a devout nationalist in that sense. And he saw in Trump a vehicle. I'm not sure who really leads this movement anymore. I'm not sure if the movement actually exists anymore. Mm-hmm. We just got through a tax bill that was essentially kind of unrelated to this sort of movement. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure if the political rhetoric and the political reality are really, really meshed up. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about this and dive into the Trump agenda of 2018. What can we expect and what should we look out for?
So, Jay, you mentioned the president's signature legislative achievement was the tax bill, which happened right at the end of 2017. The president had a big agenda, but going into 2018, there are still a bunch of things that didn't get done. So we've got a deal that potentially is in place on a budget. You've got issues that have to be resolved with respect to CHIP community health centers, disaster aid, the farm bill, and just a bucket of other issues. So what are we going to see in 2018 from the Trump agenda? What are the politics behind it? And what do you read as the kind of potential for success?
Yeah, normally in these sort of election years, Brandon, things kind of slow down.
Right.
They don't have that luxury. So just right off the top, January 19th, they've got to get another budget deal done. Except that this time, that budget deal is likely to have some form of comprehensive immigration reform sort of laced in it, because you've got the issues related to DACA that actually expire in March. And so the president is committed to wanting to do something on DACA, and the Democrats, it's a signature issue for them. They want to deal with the Dreamers. But the president won't do it without enhanced border security or a border wall with Mexico. And he wants to end something they call chain migration, which is essentially elimination of family-based immigration outside of the immediate families. And so there's a lot of moving pieces to this. We haven't even talked about the fact they've got a $1.5 trillion hole that needs to get filled as it relates to the taxes. So you're looking at the potential of cuts to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and sort of enhanced welfare reform, if you will. So you've got a lot of these other issues coming up. You mentioned the farm bill. That's still out there. So a lot on the agenda, all starting in January, moving up through March. And then you get into the meat of an election cycle. I'm not sure how any of this can actually happen.
Yeah, if it wasn't for an election cycle, my sense is the deal on the budget would be easier to accomplish. The budget framework, which was hammered out in 2011 under the Budget Control Act, force these fierce cuts. So about $6 billion in defense and domestic programs are going to be cut if it's not the case that there's some budget deal reached. So the fact that they, both Republicans and Democrats, don't think this is a good deal and don't like that plan should encourage them to play ball, right? Let's get together and try to figure something out. But the fact that it's an election year makes this really tough. And I guess this is my kind of question to you is, we've got Republicans who obviously are hungry for a win, but you've got Democrats who are, I think, in danger of violating some of the core principles that have governed the way that they have approached these policies, especially DACA, but also the need to be able to show they're resisting Trump. So how do you get some kind of movement on these policies when both sides are so intractably drawn into the politics of the election season?
Yeah, it makes it very, very hard. For Democrats, they're walking a tightrope because you've got individuals who say, look, we want DACA, we want reform for Dreamers, we want comprehensive immigration reform, but we don't want any give on border security wall, we don't want any give on reductions in terms of immigration reform. And the Democrats are wanting to, at least some of the leadership, want to really hold the line on this and use the budget deadlines as a means to get the bill you want. The problem with that is that you run the risk of shutting down the federal government effectively.
The Democrats, I think, are at risk of being blamed for a government shutdown. The opposition party is always in a position where they have to play defense on this, and the Republicans are going to have a bigger microphone, and they're going to suggest the Democrats are at fault for having that occur if it happens. So do you think that there's a risk for Democrats to kind of push this to the brink? Or do you think that that's smart politics and that's going to play well to their base?
No, absolutely. I think the idea that you're going to shut down the federal government because of DACA is incredibly problematic for Democrats, if that's the spin that they're going to use. It's one thing to say we're going to hold everyone's feet to the fire as it relates to, from a budgetary financial perspective. To introduce immigration as the reason, I think, is going to create lots of problems for them and run some risk. The problem for Democrats is they've essentially promised their core constituencies or base that they're going to get a deal done on DACA and that it is a primary movement. And we talked about it in a Texas show about the importance for Latino voters.
Yeah.
And so if you don't get a deal done, you know, what happens there? And if you do get a deal done, who's really going to get the credit?
Yeah.
Donald Trump or the Democrats?
I think the credit idea is a really good one, and that is that the Republicans are in real danger of having very little to show for their legislative accomplishments going into 2018, despite the fact that they had unified government and like a president who was going to make things happen and do deals, right? So I think failure to act lets the Democrats paint the Republicans as a do-nothing Congress, and combined with other failures, especially on Obamacare and those kind of, you know, organic repeals we saw earlier in 2017. I think this potentially drives Republican voters underground, and this would be harmful for Republicans trying to set the stage for 18 and then trying to, you know, regroup for 2020.
And the margins are hard for them now, right? Because in the Senate, it's a 51-49 margin. You've got Senator Smith. You've got Senator Jones now from Alabama.
Those are not made up. Those are real people.
Those are real people. Tina Smith, the new senator from Minnesota, and Doug Jones, a new senator from Alabama, are there. The margins are very close. You need 60 votes in the Senate now. You're past the sort of the budgetary timelines that allowed you to get away with just 51. So you need 60 votes to get anything passed. So you're going to have compromise. Yeah. And so the issue will be, you know, how strong and how unified will Democrats be in terms of essentially getting a deal done that makes sense for them and their constituencies? And how desperate are Republicans to get something passed? So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to tell you what to expect and why this 2018 agenda is so important.
So, Jay, 2018 promises to be a big year. There's going to be a lot of interesting political issues. We've talked about the legislative side of things, which obviously flows into some of the politics and is resulting from some of the politics. My sense is that I think the Democrats have some momentum they can carry into 2018. The election of Doug Jones, in particular, something with it really has activated Democrats. So I think that you're going to see them really dig in legislatively. But I also think that the Republicans see the value and the positive effect of legislating. So the tax deal in particular was something that gave them a lot of movement. And I think that they want to get things done. And so I think that at the end of the day, we'll see a more productive legislative session in 2018. But I don't know that the politics of this will be remarkably different.
Yeah, I agree. I think the politics are kind of baked in now. And so one of the interesting things will be, are there issues that they can agree on so they can essentially go back to their respective bases and say, look, we've given you what we said we would.
Everybody wins, right?
Exactly. That's normally how politics is supposed to work. It hasn't worked for a very long time. That said, I think the deadlines are really the big issue. We talked about the January 19th deadline already on the budget side. I think immigration reform gets lumped into it largely because the Democrats need it in there. You'll get a deal done. How good that deal will be the real question. It's going to be spun by both sides. And the other question is, nobody wants automatic sequestration cuts. They don't want to see the automatic reductions. Republicans don't want to see it on the defense side. Democrats don't want to see it on entitlements. And so that, I think, will be the big impetus. So you'll probably get past that. After that, I think moving forward, it's going to be nothing but politics. So I think after the 19th, it's going to be very difficult to get anything done. People are going to be locked into political mode. And to me, that's going to be what you're going to be seeing in 2018.
And I think the danger in that is that you have so many people who need federal government assistance, right? You've got CHIP that's on the brink. You've got community health issues. You've got disaster relief, right? Of which is only a handful of billions of dollars that have been allocated. So this is something that Congress needs to get together on. And I think, like we said, everybody can win if you do it right.
Well, that's a wrap for this week. Remember, we do a weekly Texas Politics Episode 2, which you can download on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Any questions? Shoot us a tweet with the hashtag PartyPoliticsPod or email us at PartyPoliticsPod@HoustonPublicMedia.org. Thanks to our super producer, Edel Halland, and to our stand-in audio engineer, Shannon Harrison.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.